When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm with John and Paul. How are you guys doing today?
We're great. Thanks very much.
Perfect. So what I'd like to talk to you guys about today is the AAJT, and I think I found the two perfect people to talk about this. If you guys, John first, would you mind doing a quick introduction to yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm an ER doc by training. I joined the military after the towers fell and went to Iraq the first time with a combat aviation unit out of Mississippi, a Mississippi Guard unit. I transitioned to special operations in roughly 2006 timeframe and worked on requirements driven development, and primarily hemorrhage control. So the device, came out of that effort. So just trying to, actually create a device that would duplicate putting a knee into the mid abdomen, which we were asking guys to do to try to stem the flow of blood. And the AAJT came out of that effort.
Perfect. Paul?
So I, slightly earlier, I'm a bit older, I joined the Army after the Falklands War. So I joined in 1983. I'm a trauma and orthopedic surgeon. I trained at the Stroke Trauma Center in Baltimore in Maryland. Got an interest in resuscitation, trauma resuscitation, fixation. I worked with UK austere surgical teams for some time. I suppose I've been in the Army 41 years now, so I'm sort of a dinosaur. But what I can do is I can operate on people, but I can only operate on live people. So I've always been interested in the interface between Rule 1 and Rule 2 care and looking to anything that gives me more live people to fix and to continue to save from point of injury to Rule 2, Rule 3, and back to CONUS and back to the UK. And my interest has been in the AAJT, and I say I have no conflict of interest to declare, but I've done quite a few of the, I suppose, major human studies on the device.
Perfect. Perfect. So I guess, John, let's start off with, like, why on earth did you invent the worst, most uncomfortable belt on earth?
Yeah, actually, one of the names that was proposed was the FAT, the Friendship Assassination Tourniquet, if you put it on. But the main reason was to try to stop blood flow to the pelvis. There was a bit of a sentinel death in U.S. Army Special Operations. A guy by the name of Bob Horrigan died in June of 2005. He went through a breach point, was shot in the pelvis. He was pulled from the breach point and put on a helicopter 4 minutes after the point of wounding. Medic realized how bad he was wounded and immediately got the air asset down. He was able to squeeze the medic's hand. They flew to the awaiting surgical team 12 minutes away. He arrived alive, but the bleeding in the pelvis was just overwhelming, and there was just no way to control it quick enough before he died. And so we really were looking to try to solve that problem. The medics, the senior assault medics, learned even how to do cut downs to try to ligate vessels within the pelvis. But that's a perishable skill, and that's literally what the extremely experienced surgical team was trying to do with Bob, and that didn't appear to be the solution. We looked at the Lister tourniquet, which was a very, very old tourniquet from the 1800s that basically looked like a C-clamp. It would be anchored in the back and go down over the navel to stop the blood flow through the aorta. The inventor of the Lister tourniquet, Lister, said that you would only find those in museums by the late 1800s, because they had then perfected going into the abdomen and cross clamping the aorta. We had two provisional patents, one on a mechanical device, which was better designed than how I stabilized it. And that ended up being the Croc that Chris Murphy invented. And then a pneumatic device. And the pneumatic device seemed to be the easier one to stabilize. When you put pressure into the abdomen, we use a wedge-shaped bladder, and it's going to want to tilt. And so the idea, all the revisions since the very initial device have been to try to stabilize it to keep it thinner and from moving over the site of application. In 2013, the military identified junctional hemorrhage as the number one priority. Paul can talk a little bit about the first combat casualty saved with the device in 2013 that the Brits had in Afghanistan. And I put it on a couple of guys about a month later, one shot in the groin and one shot through the armpit. And we were able to save both of those lives. And so that's when the device actually got renamed from the aortic abdominal aortic tourniquet to the abdominal aortic and junctional tourniquet. That's sort of the reason why the device was created. It was requirements driven. And it's been in continuous use by that unit since, and by a lot of units actually, in not just the U.S. military, but 23 of our allied nation partners have it and are in use.
Perfect, perfect. Paul, if you wouldn't mind telling me about that first application.
Well, I was the medical director of the hospital in Camp Bastion in 2013, and in consultation with a colleague, Harvey Pinn, we were, looking at these casualties where I guess the Taliban had refined how they did their IEDs. And we saw more and more proximal IEDs where it was becoming increasingly difficult to get even one or two cap tourniquets on the high thigh because we were seeing these high mid-thigh amputations. And then combined with that, this was just before we people put in the perineal support, the perineal basically body armor. We saw a lot of people with perineal injuries. So the blast had not just taken the legs off at the high thigh, they'd driven dirt and everything else into the perineal area and split the pelvis apart. And you can't get a tourniquet onto that area itself. So we discussed putting it onto the Merc, our helicopter, and with a casualty, one of our partner nation soldiers who stepped in an IED. He had bilateral lower limb amputations. He had a pelvic injury, so we treated that with putting a pelvic binder on. And then he still had continued bleeding on the MERT helicopter from the perineal area. And Harvey applied the AHAT. The casualty stabilized. We got him into in the Camp Bastion. Got him into surgery, deflated the tourniquet as we got proximal control. Casualty survived transport to Kabul 3 days later, and that was in 2013. That was published in Journal Spec Ops Med in 2013 as a case report. So that was the first. So 11 years ago, that was the first documented use and the first documented human save of someone with the AHAT.
All right, very good. Obviously we have like case reports of these happenings. What about like study data? I mean, I know of one study, but to be honest, it didn't really seem particularly fair. But also, to be fair, I don't really know studying that research that well either. But essentially, they put the tourniquets on and then removed them, and then they died. So, what kind of research into this? What kind of study data are you getting out of this?
If I can, I'll sort of fill that one. Yeah, what you're referring to, I think, is the Caribaldi 2-hour study on the device. So the Institute for Surgical Research, and part of their comments even in the, not just that paper, but others that they published, said initially we had a 1-hour application time that we were cleared for the FDA for at the abdominal site, 4 hours at the junctional site. They wanted to see what happened at 2 hours, and at 120 minutes, they actually just took the tourniquet off and didn't do any damage control resuscitative measures. And so they had created a fatal bleeding wound, and it was fatal. And so the animals died. Jason Rawl is a researcher with the U.S. Air Force's 59th Med Wing. He repeated the study, but just did standard damage control resuscitative measures. All the animals lived, and because they lived, they were able to go back in necropsy the animals and look for any histologic signs, eosinophilic stains, looking for ischemia in bowel, lung, kidneys, and found none at 2 hours. And so their 120-minute study was meant to try to clarify what the ISR was looking at. We also have a four-hour study that was done by the Swedes where there are some ischemic issues if you have that thing on for 4 hours. And the animals needed to be resuscitated within an ICU environment. However, they had no deaths from it. So there were some complications that needed to be addressed surgically with ischemia of the bowel, but none of the animals died. And so right now, the current cleared timeline for abdominal application is 2 hours, but we see actually quite a few extended application times in Ukraine. There's quite a bit of data from Ukraine with probably a little over 36 lives saved that have been documented. We know it's been applied a lot more times than that, but there's about 65 peer-reviewed literature articles on the device, on the technology, in the bibliography. And of those 65, there are probably three that have some negative connotation. There was the Caribaldi one. There was one that was a preference study done again by ISR where the physician volunteers were putting the device on each other. They were putting all the junctional devices, but instead of putting our device over the groin, which it was approved for at the time of the study, they put our device over the abdomen and the others over the groin. And it's more uncomfortable over the abdomen than it is on the groin. If the researchers felt like it was too uncomfortable, they would tap out and stop the application. In the paper, that was counted as a device failure, when really it's a patient failure, if you will. At the same time, data was presented from the C-STARS combat medics when Stacey Shackelford was at the Baltimore Shock Trauma. Both of those studies were presented at the conference that's now known as MHSRS. At the time, it was called ATAC. And they were both preference studies, and the Air Force combat medics preferred our device of the four junctional devices that were on the market at the time, where the ISR did not. And the only other one that had some negative connotation was an Israeli study where they repeated the preference study that the ISR had done. And they had a couple breakages of devices. Now, I knew the study was going to happen, and I offered to give them new devices. But the ISR, Dr. John Craig, had given them the devices and assured them, no, they've inflated hundreds of times without failure. You don't need new devices. So the device is a single-use device. We've never had one break in a single-use environment, and that's with, you know, over 7,000 of them out there. So those sort of three negative connotations are still float out there, but the remainder of the vast body of that literature is very positive.
Oh, very good. I mean, I gotta be honest, the preference study doesn't make any sense. I've yet to have a patient have the option when it comes to combat trauma, but Paul.
That by saying that our soldiers are tougher. I mean, they probably are, but
you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
We did a study with one of our airborne units, and we took 16 volunteer combat medics, like basically your 68 whiskeys, and we got them to apply the AHAT to each other. And I had it on myself at one stage as well. It does feel a bit strange. It does press down in your abdomen. You can talk, you can breathe, but we applied it to 16 combat med techs, and apart from one slightly chunkier chap, that within 30, 40 seconds, we had complete occlusion of the common femoral artery. We put Doppler onto the common femoral artery. We applied the AHAT to these volunteers. And within 30, 40 seconds, basically we had complete cessation of CFA flow. And there was no, they had the option, there was no tapping out whatsoever. And that was one of the earliest human studies that looked and said, look, we can apply these AHAT to the abdomen, and apart from one guy who maybe we could have tightened it a bit more, it was all fine. And perhaps I can mention another study we did about 2 years ago. That first study was published in Military Medicine, more recent one in our BMJ Military Health, where we took combat medics, 60 whiskies, we taught them for one hour of training. We got them to put on the AJT, and we included females. There were 7 females in this study as well, and about 25, 28 people. And again, we had no failures whatsoever. We had no tap outs amongst males or females with application of the AJT. And John himself has a nice video, and maybe he could demonstrate himself, where you put on the AJT, and it is tight. I mean, it has to be tight, but there's no screaming, there's no crying, and you can still talk. It's a very slight increase in your airway pressures. But it's tolerable. I've had it on, John's had it on multiple times. It's not, there is this misconception that it is massively painful and it requires, it's not in the slightest. So we know it works, and we know it controls, within seconds, it controls your common femoral artery and also your iliac blood flow.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine the blast that caused you to put it on is what's going to hurt, but,
well, that and the patients that I've put it on were unconscious. You know, they've gone through tremendous shock and they're in hemorrhagic shock when we apply it.
Yeah, that's usually pretty good for analgesia and sedation. It's just deep shock. So you mentioned, 2 hours is what it's approved for, and at least on the Swedish study, they went to 4 and they started having some ischemic injury that required some kind of intervention. Is there any thought to going farther, or is that kind of the known line and we don't want to try farther?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of thoughts about going farther. In fact, actually we have a number of Ukrainian physicians who are very interested in how to mitigate potential ischemic injury. If it stays on longer than that, they do have some cases that they've of the 36 or so documented saves in Ukraine of longer applications. But there are also some strategies. They're actually able to do whole blood transfusion and component transfusion. If we can get somebody to the point where we can do transfusion, and some of that's very far forward, then if they have holes and they're leaking and we put this on, and within that first 2 hours, we get them to a point where we can give them blood, then as we're giving blood, you can take down the pressure and you're going to leak, but you're not leaking everything out. And so you're maintaining certain pressures, allowing the issues related to ischemia to be mitigated slightly by the idea of the blood being given that can carry oxygen down to those tissues. Now, that sort of future studies type things that we're looking at right now, we've actually got a couple of protocols that are in development to try to look at that to get some good data on how long could we go if you had the ability to give somebody some blood and stagger the use or temporize the use. It's you could almost say it's PAJT, partial AAJT, right. Partial. In a sense. It's the Reboa folks like to do partial Reboa now, but I think there is some thought process to being able to do it longer. Now, just to let you know too, that we've had some discussions with the Ukrainian doctors that are getting these casualties, some of them that have it for more than 4 hours. And basically, it's treated like a crush protocol. So we do the same things when we're mitigating the ischemia caused by somebody that's been crushed for a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so, and we can mitigate most of the ischemic risk involved in a crush injury patient. When we get them, and in the situation where you have the AAJT in place, that ischemic challenge doesn't happen until you deflate it. And so we will tell folks, hey, listen, if you put it on and you're passing that 2 hour point, don't take it off. Wait till you get to the care, the definitive care area where they have the capability of mitigating the issues related to ischemia by alkalizing the urine and using CRT and a number of different things. So,
yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense. And that was one of the other questions I had is, you know, they have like the partial Reboa now. Now, if you wouldn't mind, can we just go through like putting the device on and pressures involved? So, because I'm interested, like what, you know, the occlusion pressure, whatever that ends up being, I'm going to assess pulses. If their pulses are absent, I'm assuming that it's on tight enough. What would you reduce? What would you reduce that pressure to if you're trying to do, you know, some at least intermittent reperfusion?
Well, it's a great question. I'll give you my perspective. I'm sure Paul can give you his. The device has a manometer on it that has color codes. It turns green at 250 millimeters mercury pressure. The reason being that the human studies, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., the maximum pressure to occlude the aorta was 230 millimeters mercury pressure. You actually need less pressure over the axilla and the inguinal space. So 250 catches everybody. So when they're training it, they're just told to go to green, inflate to green. As soon as they see green, they can stop. If they keep pumping up and they hit 300 millimeters mercury pressure, which is in the red, there's a built-in relief valve to the manometer and it'll bleed back down to green, which is also important when we apply it and then we take somebody by air. And so as we go up and ambient air pressure decreases, the internal bladder pressure increases. And so this prevents overpressurization of the bladder. So that's why the pressures were chosen the way they were. And that's significant. You know, the SAM junctional tourniquet studied by Johnson at Wake Forest showed that the pressures required for it to work in the groin were around 740 millimeters of mercury pressure. The ISR found that the CROC, when it was working, required pressures as high as 800 to 900 millimeters of mercury pressure. But those pressures are high enough to cause tissue necrosis and permanent nerve damage. And so 250, that's barely above what your doctor's blood pressure cuff puts on when you're in the office. So it was felt to be safe. It is safe. The Navy's Medical Expeditionary Unit tested the pressures underlying the device against the skin and found that the pressure in the manometer, when it says 250, it's 250 on the skin, pressing into the belly. The biggest advantage in the design of the device over the other junctional tourniquets is the surface area in which it's applied. So the bladder is about 8 inches wide, and it's a large surface area, and that's how we can use less pressure. It also makes it to where you really don't have to have medical anatomical knowledge to apply it. It's the no-brainer device. You just put it, if you can follow pictograms, you can put it on the right place. The other reason that it really sort of won out in the special operations community is it does not move or lose hemorrhage control when we move people, because we're bending them, hoisting them, dragging them. And so what we found with the other junctional tourniquets was just simply moving a patient onto a litter or from a litter onto a gurney, you can lose hemorrhage control because they're very point specific. And this is more an area application or a regional pressure device than a point specific pressure device. So collateral flow doesn't tend to be an issue related to the hemorrhage control you get with a device.
Okay, perfect, perfect. So, I mean, obviously hemorrhage control device, that's definitely the good aspect of it. It's nice and wide. So you're getting nice, even pressure. You're catching all the collateral, perfusion without like drilling a hole through somebody. Like if you're putting your fist through them or, dropping a knee or something like that, you know, there's gotta be some kind of negative consequences to this. You can't put, you know, 250, 300 millimeters of mercury on somebody for hours and hours and hours and have nothing, right? So, like, what's the negative consequence?
Can I just maybe just suggest that John just stands up for a second, just puts it on himself in a couple of seconds, just we should see where the I know he's going to suck himself in here, but just
you see how he's volunteering me and not volunteering himself to do this.
Well, he said he forgot actually, his, so.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. His is in use somewhere. So it has a very long belt that's 3 inches wide. At the end of the belt, it's 64 inches. So it'll go around 64 inches of girth. The whole system will. So you can put it around a very large person. At the end of the belt is a ladder strap that engages into the ratcheting buckle. The ladder strap's about 13 inches, so you can actually slide that in the small of the back around the casualty. And it's got a red mark on the ladder strap, and we tell them to go red to red. So we've got a red mark on the receiving buckle, and the idea is when red meets red, it's enough for that ladder strap to be engaged into the buckle, so it's anchored. Mm-hmm. And then there are pull handles on the belt to take all the slack out of the belt. So once the slack is removed, just like any tourniquet system, you take all the slack out of the system before you tighten it. You complete the tightening with the ratchet. So about five pulls is usually enough to get it nice and cinched up. And then it's just inflation until you see the green.
Okay.
So.
Watch John collapse here.
What's that? Yeah, no. I put this thing on thousands of times.
I've heard John lecture for like 20 minutes for this thing applied. I mean, obviously, I would joke and say his toes turned black, but of course they didn't turn black. And this is a great thing to watch because this puts completely to rest, yeah. And you'll see this thing turn green. It only turns green when it turns to 250 millimeters of mercury. So John has pretty much now occluded his aorta by pressing it against the back of his spine, and he will have no common femoral artery blood flow now. You can see it's fully inflated, and John is going to talk for a couple of seconds. John, as soon as you can still breathe,
And I can talk fine because I think that the idea is, does it affect diaphragmatic movement? Mm-hmm. And it does a little bit, but not to the point that I can't have full sentences. I can't talk. My legs start getting a little numb. You don't want to do this with a full bladder. it's uncomfortable, but in my opinion, it's less painful than a CAT tourniquet put on correctly. Those things actually hurt whenever you're squeezing down with that pressure. And part of it's because of the area in which it's being applied. But I like demonstrating it because one of the questions that we would get from medics was, hey, am I going to have a hard time ventilating somebody if I put this on? And you can. You can ventilate them fine. It's just a matter of putting it down here and realizing that it does not affect the diaphragmatic movement. So when we're training it, when the medics put them on each other, we actually ask them, okay, have a conversation. Can you talk? Well, yeah, I can feel it's uncomfortable, but it's not impossible to do. One other thing I'll mention is that I mentioned a 64 inch girth, and we all often get questions. Well, does it work on a large person? And fortunately, most of the military personnel are not very large. This actually also goes down to about 10 inch circumference. There's not actually an age restriction on its use. We also have a number of veterinarians looking into it for working dogs and other animals as well. But if you put it on a large person, they have more soft tissue. And so we're all small people on the inside, and it basically uses that surface area and pushes down into the abdomen to compress the same way it does on somebody that's not as big. Oftentimes, the larger people also have less defined abdominal musculature. If you're awake and you're resisting this device and pushing really hard with your muscles in your abdominal wall, you can actually get this to read 250 without full occlusion of the aorta because you're pushing as hard as you can. Yep. Now, most of the casualties I put it on are unconscious. They're not able to push on anything. And as soon as you're able to tell someone who is tensing, just relax. And because they're scared, I guess, about the idea of something pushing in on their stomach like that, then they're fine. Just to show you to release the device, I took the air out of the bladder. And there's a center release in the buckle itself. So you can just pull that and it lays open so you can reassess the patient. And then if you need to reapply, then you can just reinsert the ladder strap, tighten it down, and then go ahead and inflate. So you don't have to mess with the strap if you take it off in that manner.
Yep. That makes sense.
I can answer those questions. So, I mean, When previously I was training,
I was just going to mention while you.
No, go ahead.
Please go ahead.
No, okay. So when we talked about training for Afghanistan in sort of the zeros and tens and stuff like that, we would do a scenario with a medic and, you know, maybe a pre-hospital care doctor, and basically at 15 minutes, they're all looking at the sky saying, where's the big helicopter, the Pedro, the Merit, whatever, coming to take people away? So you asked about, are there any downsides? Sure there are. Prolonged application is, you know, the longer it's on, you know, 2 hours is fine, 4 hours is okay-ish, plus that is tricky. But we're not in the next war, whether it's Taiwan, and we look at Ukraine, we've got some, it took us a while, but we've got some good data coming out of Ukraine now, collating this and presenting it at SAMHSA, is that unfortunately, if you're injured in the morning in Ukraine, the chances are that your likelihood of survival is less, because you've got to wait till darkness to be Kazabak. If you're a lone soldier, I mean, the enemy does target the rescue teams, and you see the pictures of the ambulances, mm-hmm. the army ambulances being shot up by the enemy. So whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Taiwan, in the future, this air superiority idea is gone. The Red Cross itself is almost seen as a target. So we have to look, I think, or look beyond the horizon and say, is there something we can do that, yes, with prolonged application, plus 4 hours, and John very clearly mentioned about with whole blood, we release for a bit, we get some revascularization, and then reapply the tourniquet. But the Ukraine data is clearly showing that pre-hospital times are 2, 4, 6, 8, 12 hours. And we need to look at things, whether it's the AJT, whether it's foams, but it needs to be a device or a technique that is applied within seconds by non-physicians, by medic caregivers, and that's the key. Anything that's too technical that requires you to open massive kit and your prep, and that's anything to 8 to 12 minutes under fire, that's a non-starter. So yeah, 2 hours, we think 2 hours is fine. We're continuing to develop a Ukraine. I suppose assessment, release, reapplication, and John mentioned crush syndrome. You know, we need to look at strategies to mitigate that pre-hospital care where it takes hours now to get the surgery into a rule two.
No, that makes 100% sense. And the risk of like a reperfusion injury, crush syndrome type thing, that's just, part of the game, right? You have a long tourniquet times, extremity tourniquet times, you're going to have to play that game. And, just knowing that to begin with, at least I understand, hey, I have to be prepared. Where are my fluids, calcium? I need some kind of monitoring. I can't just do stuff. You have to be prepared for stuff. Let's get the stuff ready. Okay, now, can actually at least begin to start to deal with this, this reperfusion injury, crush syndrome type stuff. And to be honest, you mentioned, being able to talk and breathe and relax. That was the first thing I thought the first time I saw that. I was like, well, that's pushing his guts into his diaphragm. Like that at some point he's, going to have a difficult time just breathing. And usually patients that would probably need that are breathing really deep, really rapidly. And, any kind of hindrance is going to catch up to them eventually, But that's great that it just, you mentioned that it just increased their inspiratory pressure from like 17 to, low 20s, which isn't really that big of a change.
Yeah, that was some data that was pulled from a hemicorporectomy study. We were able to take anesthetized animals that were ventilated and look at their peak inspiratory pressures with and without the application of the device. It raises it a little bit, but not to a point that it affects their care.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like you don't have to intubate and now ventilate to overcome this device. It's positioning, maybe, supplemental oxygen, maybe. One of the other questions I had is when you had the device on, okay, it goes out to green. When I'm thinking about I'm giving him blood, I would like to start reperfusing some of these, the distal extremities. like, how do I know how much to reduce the pressure? And is it just when he starts bleeding again, then I've got it? Or like, how would I, what technique would I use?
It's a great question. We really don't have the data to tell you exactly what to do. There's another demarcation line on the manometer for 150 millimeters of mercury pressure. Not strong enough to occlude the aorta on the majority of patients. And so we don't know if you could go down to a partial pressure while you're doing transfusion and that would allow it. Or do you just decrease all the pressure while you are transfusing somebody? And as long as they maintain their blood pressure, allow their circulatory system to work as best as it can. You know, the reason we're putting it on is we believe there are holes in the pipes. And yep. So you've got a leak. Are there holes in all the pipes? Probably not. Is the hole in the big pipe at that point sufficient to take all the blood you're putting in and let it drain out that hole instead of to the legs? So we don't really have all of those answers. I think the idea that we've circulated with the Ukrainians is they are able to do blood for forward, both whole blood and component transfusions. And if they're able to initiate blood transfusion and release the pressure of the device and get that entire unit of blood in while the patient might be permissive hypotension, but still maintaining enough perfusion to get the oxygen into the core of the body, then at the end, then you just tighten it back down when you stop doing your transfusions or you're ready to transport again. And then you sort of reset the clock, if you will. Okay. But I don't have any idea of how to tell you, does 30 minutes giving a transfusion and decreasing the pressure really reset the clock to 2 hours, or are they going to have ischemia? Because anytime you put something on and you stop blood flow, you get some ischemic change. So the idea of it being on for 2 hours, does not say, oh, there's no ischemic change in 2 hours. It's just that the ischemic change that occurs over that 2 hour of application is minimal enough that you can take it off without having to do any intervention up to that 120 minute point. There's definitely some more research that needs to happen. But what we've ended up sort of giving guidance in the field is bring me a live patient so I can deal with the complications. And so if it stays on for more than 2 hours, if they're alive when they come to the door, it's a lot better than a dead person coming through the door.
Yep. Absolutely agree. Yep. And I think, you know, we just have to be honest with ourselves about any intervention. You just have to know the good and the bad about it in order to make a wise one so that you can accommodate for the other things. And, you know, I think a lot of people want, you know, one size fit all answers that we can just now forget about problems. And I mean, that's just not true, you know?
Yeah, I think if risk benefit, if everything we do has risk benefit, and when you're when you're doing a heroic intervention, okay, so you're talking about somebody who's exsanguinating, then the benefit is pretty straightforward. Stop the exsanguination. The risks related, I don't know that any of them rise to the level of, you know, the benefit of stopping the exsanguination.
No, so, I mean, it
doesn't mean that there's not risks, but, you know, when you're juggling that decision matrix, if you're putting it on for exsanguinating hemorrhage, then the decision is to me quite simple. Just put it on. Every single one of those precious little red blood cells that drops onto the ground are no good to you. So any of those that leave the blood vessels, leave the body, they can't carry oxygen to the tissues anymore. And so the quicker we can do that, you know, Paul was alluding to the 8 to 12 minute time frame that a trained team with Reboa takes to get a casualty and then have a balloon inflated. It's just a lot of time. It probably is why the outcomes have been bad. I mean, Paul, you could talk to more of that, I'm sure, related to Reboa.
Sure. Sure, yeah. I mean, as I said before, we can train medics to put this on in sort of, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And that's the problem with, I mean, the studies show that there's a nice figure, which is that every minute that you take to get control of major hemorrhage has a 5% increase in mortality. So once you're looking at sort of, you know, doing the maths, once you've got 12 minutes to get hemorrhage control, then you're looking at, no matter how good your device is, you're looking at 40, 50% increase in mortality. So, and also, mm-hmm. as a physician, physicians are expensive, and you know, some are expendable, some aren't. But this, joking apart, but we need something that's, you know, in the future battlefields, there aren't enough physicians to go around, even mm-hmm. emergency physicians and anaesthetists. So we need to look at something, as we said, that is doable, reproducibly, you know, 100% time after time, delivered by combat medics within seconds. So Reboa, if we look at, as one colleague said, there are more papers written about Reboa than actually Reboa devices have been inserted. But it takes time to put on. But the UK Reboa trial is just reported. And many of us had doubts, but we did see that it was a very good randomized control trial that was being undertaken, you know, centre-wide, you know, around the UK. They were meant to recruit 120 people. And a randomized controlled trial, and at 90 people, they had to stop because it was shown that the 90-day mortality was increased by the use of Reboa. The transfusion requirements were increased. So basically, what was clear was that Reboa caused harm when it was applied to people. And there's been a number of other similar studies in JAMA, and we're showing that at best Reboa makes no difference. And the problem, it also seems to divert. It's very sexy. People in orange jumpsuits in helicopters come along. They do the Reboa. People talk about Ranger Reboa. But it's difficult to do. And if you look at what really saves people, it's a really good, simple skill. CABC, done well, saves most people. So a lot of, there was a recent discussion at a conference in London, and a lot of our local emergency medical, the HEMS teams, helicopter emergency medical teams, are saying, look, we really can't use Reboa anymore because it causes harm. And people are saying, why are we continuing to use this this device? So we're looking to try and look at other things, not just obviously AJT, abdominal foams, gastroesophageal resuscitation of the aorta. There's other techniques. We do need to be taking some risk to be looking at the other techniques that are available. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as it stands right now, Reboa, and again, a recent study has shown that partial Reboa is just as bad as regular Reboa, so there's no increase or better in them. I think it's fair to say there are also papers that show that a lot of the studies on Reboa have been funded by the Reboa device manufacturers, and with undeclared conflict of interest, and that's, I think, a worry for some of these studies. So we previously used to compare the AHAT to Reboa, thinking that was, well, maybe early on it might have had some promise, but we realize now that it takes too long to do, and it probably doesn't work in the way that people think it does. So we need to look at other ways of treating junctional and non-compressible torso hemorrhage.
Yep, makes 100% sense. So guys, do you have anything else you'd like me to know about Reboa? Or sorry, AJT.
Yeah, actually, Paul, I think Paul did some studying, some research in September of last year that I think was very, very compelling, and he'll be presenting some at SOMA this year.
Nice.
So I think, so there was a question, and some people asked this question, that if we did put the A, and we knew absolutely that the AAJT compresses not just the aorta, but also includes the IVC. So it's very powerful, but it's also titratable. Unlike the foam, doesn't just do one fill and you're done. We can titrate it with the bladder. So AAJT compresses the aorta and the IVC against the aorta. People said, if you've got a hole above, like maybe around the celiac axis or the superior mesenteric artery, or does it actually increase bleeding? So we got permission to do a human cadaveric study done in Brighton, and thanks to Brighton for letting us do this. So on cadavers, what we did was we put a manometric balloon into the epigastrium, just here, also a little manometric balloon in the just above the pelvis itself, normalized that to what's called, to normal intra-abdominal pressure, and then we inflated the AHAT. Then we repeated the study with 500 mils of blood, actually just fluid, into the abdomen itself. what we're able to show very clearly was that there was a 50 to 60%, the intra-abdominal pressure increased to basically 60 centimeters of water, which is about 40 millimeters of mercury. And we know, as other studies very clearly show from abdominal compartment syndrome, that relates to a 50, 67% decrease in splenic superior mesenteric and celiac axis blood flow, plus also maybe a 70% decrease in splenic blood flow and liver blood flow and liver bleeding. So we not only see now, we think there's the zone 3 REBOA basically effect better than done within seconds. But we also now think we can see, demonstrate a zone 1 REBOA effect with the AHAT, where we're getting easily zone 3 control just by simply compressing the aorta and the IVC, but also the increase in intra-abdominal pressure, producing a 70% decrease in upper abdominal blood flow for liver, spleen, and celiac axis bleeding. So, you know, we need to get more data. That's absolutely clear. This was just a cadaver work, but we're presenting this at SOMA, and we've submitted it to Journal of Spec Ops Meds. We're hoping that's going to be published soon. But we think that it's applicable by combat medics. We know it produces a very clear zone 3 effect. We know it produces a junctional effect in the axilla and in the groin. We know it can be applied to the neck, obviously not right around the neck, but from the neck down to the into the axilla itself. It weighs about 450 grams, and it's easily applied and it's reproducible. So we have to be clear that, I think some people don't accept this, but there's a war coming. There's a couple of wars coming. We need to be ready for those wars, and we need to look over the horizon at things that, you know, may have some risk, but with the best animal, recent cadaver studies show that it does stop bleeding.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Dennis, I think the non-compressible torso hemorrhage question is the real hot topic. It's still the number one military medical priority. If somebody gets wounded in the liver or has a named abdominal vascular injury below the diaphragm, that there's really just very little, if anything, that we can do. And so that's what the foams are all sort of focused at. But the foams are still a little ways off. There's one foam in human trial up in Pittsburgh in their enrollment phase now, trying to get data. But who knows how long that might take? Another year, year and a half before we have access to that in the field. The interesting thing to me about Paul's study, when they called and said, "Hey, look, this is what we found up there," is that they're using the abdominal location and application that we've been doing for 11 years now. There's no difference. There's no difference in placement. It's just over the umbilicus. And then the internal interabdominal compartment pressures that they were measuring are the point behind the foams. So if you inject the foam, it expands and it increases that interabdominal compartment pressure to create that compartment syndrome to stem the flow of blood from the liver or vascular injuries up there. What we're saying is, listen, we've got a fielded device right now that has the capability of treating the number one priority. We don't have to wait for the foams. We can use this in this situation right now. Our company is going for an FDA indication along these lines to be able to market it that way. But Paul's research is a very compelling piece of data that I think is very meaningful. The idea of the foams also going in, and then you can't do anything about it once they're in. So the only person that can do something about that is the surgeon that opens them up. So you create that compartment syndrome, and it's undoable. And the AJT, it's just based on the pressure that you're applying. So it is somewhat titratable in the idea that if you, again, get to somebody where you can give them a blood transfusion, they've got a hole, you want to lessen that effect of that interabdominal compartment syndrome, then you can give them blood potentially lessen the pressure and have a mechanism in which to treat this non-compressible torsor hemorrhage. But more definitively, he answered the question of what about a hole above? And we had known that we had had patients that had lived after application of the AHAT who had holes above, but this is the first time we really have sort of the data as to, well, this is the why behind that.
Yeah, perfect.
Also, it's important to say that the AHAT can be, there'll be times when the AHAT will be applied and it wasn't needed. So we'll take someone, we'll get them, we'll scan them, and you'll see, actually, you did good, because, you know, no one wants to argue with the guys and girls, you know, at the front line, you know, at the point of injury. But we'll see some people who AHAT has been applied, and the when we scan them, whatever, that there's not actually an injury below in the abdomen itself. So then we can take off the AHAT and say you did good, but actually this needs done now, new laparotomy. And as John says, the problem with the foams as it stands, and great research, and it's something else to look at, but you don't need to do a laparotomy. You simply just let the balloon down and take off the AHAT.
Yeah, no, it's the exact same thing. I mean, essentially everybody's been seeing with tourniquets applied to, you know, venous bleeds or anything that a tourniquet wasn't actually appropriate for. Perfect, guys. Is there anything else we need to add?
No, I think that it's been approved for use by the British Army now in January of this year. We're looking to field it. We're very clear that we're going to introduce it with as a study. We do all need more data. We're getting, obviously, the war in Ukraine goes on. We're getting better data out of Ukraine now as well. But it's in use. We're looking for the data. Further data, because it's important to keep studying these things. But the last point, I suppose, is we need to be ready for the next war and stop fighting the last one.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Dennis, I think I will add one last thing. Sure. You know, Paul had mentioned that one of his focuses is in the transition between role one and role two. In Ukraine, they've used it in role one, and they've used it in the transition. So a lot of the application videos that we're getting from the front lines are the medics putting it on in the evacuation resource, getting to the stabilization site. The 59th Mechanized Brigade is the unit in Ukraine that has used the device the most. And they actually also have found it to be very helpful in the Role 2 environment, in the actual mm-hmm. battalion aid station, the far surgical site, not only to control hemorrhage, just to give them an extra ability just to shut the faucet off while they're trying to figure out this mangled yep. mess, which vessels are actually injured or not. But traumatic cardiac arrest is mm-hmm. something that came to the forefront because of the Air Force's 59th Med Wing in 2017. Jason Rall did a study looking at pigs that were bled to asystole for 3 full minutes. And then the device was applied, you gave blood and did CPR. So any traumatic arrest, you have to be able to give blood. What these and he had an 83% ROSC, which was almost mind blowing. Cause I've told paramedics for years, if you show up and somebody's heart's not beating and it's from trauma, don't work it because they're dead. But now more and more units, both civilian and military, are able to do blood for forward. The Australians did a study in 2019 using a helicopter service responding to scene flights on traumatic cardiac arrest. They had about a 22% ROSC, but their asystolic times were the mean asystolic time was 16 minutes. So just mm-hmm. too long without oxygen. The San Antonio Fire Department, UT San Antonio, decided that they could get there a lot quicker than 16 minutes. And so they started enrolling patients in November 21 and presented data last year at EMS World that showed they also had, they had some prolonged asystolic times. It wasn't 16 minutes, probably over 5. And they had about a 22% ROSC. However, their patients all left neurologically intact from the hospital. Then the Ukrainian surgeon that we've worked with the most, in fighting in Bakhmut in June of 22, he had six patients that came in who died after arrival. Okay, so traumatic cardiac arrest from hemorrhage. The standard approach is to clamshell open the chest, cross-clamp the aorta, give blood, massage the heart, and those kind of resuscitative measures. But instead of cutting open the chest, he applied the device, gave blood, did CPR, and they had 100% ROSC on those six patients. One of the patients had a delay. The evacuation resource was destroyed by the enemy, so they couldn't evacuate him, and ultimately the guy expired at the station. The other five all made it to the next level of care. By the way, once they achieved ROSC, they had normalized blood pressures without pressors. So they got ROSC by giving blood, doing CPR, and they saved those. And for the ones that he was able to keep in contact with at 1 year, they were alive, neurologically intact. So the idea of ability, so Enrique Ginsberg down at University of Miami, he's over the four trauma centers down there, is very interested in the traumatic cardiac arrest use and getting away from just cutting somebody's chest open, because that comes with a lot of costs to the patient, even if they do survive. And they are also very interested in it replacing their remaining use of REBOA, which was zone 3 for pelvic bleeding. So another clinical vignette is going to be presented at SOMA by Chad Rodmore, who's a medic with the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Unit. And they put it on a parachutist that burned in, had a failure to open. She hit, never lost consciousness, didn't hit her head, but broke her pelvis to hell. They put it around the pelvis, tightened it down. She was hypotensive. They inflated actually at the pelvis. So they were using it as a pelvic binder and then just inflated right there. And she survived, went through her surgeries, and actually has made a full recovery. And so he's going to be giving that presentation. So I think the traumatic cardiac arrest and its use in the pelvic fracture, pelvic bleeding space is what the civilian side has been very interested in. But the traumatic cardiac arrest opens up some new avenues of approach for taking these severely injured casualties that we're bringing to the surgical stabilization site, the forward surgical team, and giving them some more options as well.
And my final point would be,
hey, thank you guys very much.
In traumatic cardiac arrest, any intervention that takes 8-12 minutes to do, like REBOA, is just a non-starter.
Yeah.
Whether it's AAG, whatever you're going to use, it needs something that puts on in seconds, and AAGT does that. I've seen it 37 seconds, bang, on, even while the casualty's moving or someone's doing CPR or anything else like that. Anything that takes 8-12 minutes while you're pounding on a casualty. Sorry, is my last point.
Yeah. I mean, 16 minutes without oxygen to their brain, Steve is not going to be Steve anymore anyway. So, now people have to look at, functional outcomes as well, which is sad, but it's true. Again, thank you guys very much. I really, really appreciate being able to sit down and talk to you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Our boy is waiting there for you.